We're joined on the line by our guest,
David Oakes, and he is from the Mind Freedom Support Coalition International. And just to give a bit of background before we get to David, he's going to be speaking to us about an article that Jamie read last week, which was on dominionpaper.ca, and it was about a Bush administration plan to screen all United States citizens for mental illness. So this initiative is the outcome of the president's new Freedom Commission on Mental Health, which is or was a year-long task force which concluded by making recommendations to improve, quote unquote, the mental health of Americans, including mandatory nationwide screening of individuals for mental illness. The screening is to be based on the Texas Medication Algorithm Program, or TMAP, that was established in 1995, coincidentally when Bush was the governor of Texas. TMAP is designed to standardize treatments for various diagnoses ranging from schizophrenia to depression, and its use and influence has spread to over 9 states. So, this article does quote David Oakes, and we've got him on the line. Hello, David.
Hi, thanks for your work.
Yeah, thanks for being on the show. Very exciting. As I was telling you earlier, a lot of people that we've been talking to about this kind of can't believe that it's true.
Right, it's absolutely proven. The President's new Freedom Commission met, and in fact we had one of our members on the commission who managed to hold off calls for more court-ordered treatment on that commission, and so that was a kind of a small victory, but the Army marched on in terms of the mental health system, which is, you know, since I've been doing this work for 30 years, the mental health system has wanted to screen everybody. They've always wanted to do that, so we've seen that happen for many, many years, but what's different is that this is a president's commission, the president signed off on it, and they are actually doing it. There's a number of states that are engaging in this universal screening where everybody gets screened. And on the face of it, a lot of folks, feel that it sounds good, you know, looking for troubled kids, looking for troubled adults. The way they're going after kids is through the schools. They're going after adults by training your general practitioner, your family physician to ask certain questions. So on the face of it, it might sound good looking for troubled kids. The problem is it's really throwing gasoline on the fire of the mental health industry, because if you follow the money, as Mother Jones did in their May-June magazine, excellent story on this, as they found, the pharmaceutical industry helped write, create, and promote these screening programs. So they really act as a dragnet to find more and more and more clients to put onto psychiatric drugs. So it's a real deal. In fact, there have been several court cases where whistleblowers are suing about this, and one of these investigations has already been successful, and a state official in Pennsylvania was fined several thousand dollars because he was found taking bribes from the drug industry to promote this screening program in Pennsylvania. So it's already it's a matter of court record, and there's lots and lots of websites that are covering the story now.
Can you explain to us what the TMAP is? The
right. Yeah. Well. I talked to our folks down in Texas that were there in the beginning, and it was sold in the beginning as a way to standardize how mental health professionals will respond to folks who present with emotional and mental problems. But the way it ended up was that the drug industry managed to get its hands on it, which is pretty easy for them. They're one of the richest industries in the history of the planet. And so when TMAP was actually written and finished, what it became is kind of a protocol, a step-by-step procedure about what to do if somebody has a mental emotional problem, and that's drug them. And the drug companies were actually most interested in these standardized approaches because they were able to put the most expensive drugs first. The really newer, more expensive drugs would be tried first. They would try several of those, and then they would try the cheaper drugs, and then electroshock is listed. During the Bush administration in Texas, in which there's a real a climate of deferring to corporations as having this supposedly greater knowledge than the general public. So TMAP is one of the screening programs. There's also Teen Screen from Columbia University that's already in a number of schools. And I've never seen the mental health system as frightened by the groundswell of concern from the public. They're putting out web pages trying to defend themselves. Teen Screen has a web page trying to defend themselves. They're now trying to say, well, it's not really mandatory, it's universal. And there's a difference between universal and mandatory. But when the President of the United States calls for universal screening, everybody to be screened, there's a certain amount of pressure and coercion behind that. And as the Mother Jones article showed, some people can actually be forced treated, some kids, over the objections of their parents.
Well, and there's always sort of an implication that if there's universal screening, it's not mandatory, but if you don't go for screening, then, oh, there must be something wrong with you, right?
Well, you know,
it's that same idea that when there's mandatory drug searches, that if you're scared, it must be because you're carrying, you know, you're guilty, that kind
right,
of thing.
Right. Well, you know, it's really clear on some of the human rights violations we deal with. Like we fought forced electroshock, you know, where people are marched down the hall, they have electroshock against their will, which is common all over the world. And that's real obvious to people. That's a human rights violation. But it's a little more subtle, but still a really important human rights violation when the government pushes an approach on people without any scientific evidence, pushes an approach on people so that when they're troubled or need help or they're just different or acting or thinking differently, there's kind of a conveyor belt effect where they end up on psych drugs. And that's what we're seeing. We're seeing 18-month-old children end up on psych drugs. The public's been convinced there's a chemical imbalance epidemic when there's actually, that's just a theory. There's no evidence. It's as much evidence as there is for astrology. There's no evidence for it. It's fun to believe in it, but there's no evidence for it.
And about, just to confirm for people what electroshock therapy is, it's basically like electrocuting people's brains, right?
It's running electricity through the brain to induce a convulsion. And it's been going on for, you know, about 55, 60 years. And they claim that there's new improved electroshock, but actually what they're doing is just using anesthesia, muscle paralyzer, and it's still brain damage. And after right. brain damage, there can be personality change, including denial of problems and even giddiness. But the big picture on this is that the Western model of emotional problems is being sold and globalized. And that is, you look at a person as kind of a machine and you say, well, they're chemicals and electricity, so the answer must be chemicals and electricity. But the drugs are expensive. And so what we're seeing is in developing countries that are trying to be modern, they can't afford the drugs, but electricity's everywhere. And so our group, Mental Disability Rights International, which is one of the 100 groups in our Mind Freedom Coalition, they're documenting a rise of forced electroshock in Asia, Pakistan, South America. Our group in India is seeing the same thing, where, you know, to be modern, they're zapping people because the drugs are so expensive. So this is one of the costs of the globalization of the medical, the corporate medical model of emotional problems.
Unbelievable.
Just as a quick comment to our listeners as well, we do electroshock therapy here in Nanaimo Regional General Hospital. So this isn't something that's just happening in other places. It's happening here in Nanaimo as well.
Including forced electroshock, lack of informed consent, and even many, many electroshocks to one person. Yeah.
I just want to back up a little bit and talk about you said standardized screening. So is that like like sort of a multiple choice test, and if you get the right answers, you know.
Right. Yeah, they have a series of questions that ask, you know, have you been losing sleep? Are you feeling upset? Are you feeling sad? Have you lost interest in your daily affairs and so forth? And again, on the face of it, it may sound good looking for somebody who's in trouble, but you have to look at the context of the mental health system that we're dealing with, which is, you know, what kind of help is available to people who are in trouble. You know, there ought to be a full range of alternatives, including good counseling, peer support, nutritional approaches, a whole range of approaches, even in things like eco-psychology, using nature as an environment for healing, touch, massage. All kinds of approaches work for people in emotional distress. But what happens is they're not offered that. Typically, if you feel like you're going to hurt yourself, or you know, a loved one is having a crisis, or and you turn for help, out comes the prescription pad, and it's primarily drug. One of the reasons is that you can buy and sell drugs. You know, you can't buy and sell love, community, support, empowerment,
Good
all
point.
These things that we know help people, closeness, and these very rich personal relationships that people crave and animals crave, you know, that everybody needs. You can't buy and sell those on the marketplace. So you have a system that's creating emotional distress, but they can't fix it. So they're buying and selling drugs.
I think drugs should be a last resort. These kinds of drugs that can be so dangerous and experimental, like you say.
The thing as well is that what we're seeing is people are having sane responses to living in an environment that's not good for them. So if a lot of people these days are feeling a bit depressed and alienated, it's because we live in a world that does make us feel alienated, and we feel separated from nature and from a lot of the things you were talking about, like love and basic community support and all these kinds of things that I think are survival necessities. So in a way, it's kind of saying, oh, if you don't fit into this system that we're living in, you must be insane, or you must be, there must be a chemical imbalance with you. But actually, I think it's a sane response. I mean, if you went into Nazi Germany and did mental health screening on everyone at that time, I'm sure lots of people would be depressed, or people living through a war zone.
Right, and who writes the screening? I mean, what we know about the labels, which the main label Bible is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, the DSM. That's voted on. I've been there when the psychiatrists vote on it. It's a few hundred very rich, primarily white males literally sit and vote. And you can bet things like greed and corporate dominance and polluting the environment, they don't get into the DSM or to the International ICD. So if you think that things like the WTO and so forth are not very democratic, well, the DSM and the labels are internationally used, and it's just a few hundred rich white males voting on it. So we actually have a Heal Normality campaign to kind of use humor to turn the tables, and we identify what's called normality as being the most serious, disturbing disturbance and dangerous disorder, what's called normality, this kind of consensus psychosis that it's okay to be passive and obedient and listen to the big corporate media and do what they say, and that this is normality. And so we say heal normality, you know, first, before you go after us.
I'd like to talk again about the standardized test. It seems to me one of the things that I would think that is, if you get a bunch of standardized tests, you might end up not needing sort of so-called qualified people like your general practitioner or a psychologist or a counselor to recommend drugs. If you can just have people go in, take the test, and if you get a certain score on the test, you know, if you get 5, that means you take this drug, and if you get 10, that means you need this. I wonder if that could happen, if they're moving toward, you know, so that they don't have to pay.
That's what the protocols do, like a Texas medication algorithm. It's a flow chart, like a computer flow chart, that says if you do this or say this or respond this way, then try this drug, then try this drug.
Wow.
And number, I forgot what level it is, but a few levels down, it's electroshock. And so it's this primarily corporate medical model response. So again, you know, watching for people in trouble, that's important. But coming out and doing a dragnet where you just shake out more clients, and then where do they go? What happens to them? Just the act of being labeled itself can be traumatizing. It can affect your career, your insurance, your job, your marriage. The labeling process is a process that can be very frightening. People are segregated from our society and told, I was told when I was in the 1970s, when I experienced the mental health system, I was told I had a genetic, hardwired chemical imbalance. I was different from everybody else. I had to be on drugs the rest of my life. That's a traumatizing process where you label people and separate them off from everybody else. And you know, the fact is, everybody needs mental and emotional support. It's not like this 5%, 10%, 20% that especially are very, very somehow different from everybody else. Everybody needs it. And segregating you off from everybody else, that can make things worse. You can feel hopeless that it's genetic and chemical and you can't do anything about it. So the mental health system needs a nonviolent revolution. We need to hear from clients and former clients about what really helps. We need the population to get hands-on. Democracy needs to meet the mental health system and get hands-on with it. We're kind of like where nuclear power was in the 1950s, where the public just feels, well, that's kind of too complicated for me to get involved in. But nowadays, you couldn't put a nuclear power plant in British Columbia without the general public wanting to get involved and speak out about it. Well, they should do the same thing on mental health, is to get very informed about what these drugs do, what kind of alternatives there are, the meaninglessness of the labels, the fact that it's a pseudoscience about the chemical imbalance. We got to get hands-on with this system, or else it can get hands-on with you.
So I'd like to go back to, how I guess we sort of know how the screening would work. I understand how the test would work, but
yep.
Like if it's sort of mandatory, or let's call it universal, what would that mean?
Mm-hmm.
Would that mean that you sort of you have, you know, it's like the draft, you have to sign up and then go in? Or,
well, there's two, they are the system does is worried. It's worried about the general public. In fact, by the way, it's both left wing and right wing groups are speaking out about screening. So what they are quickly trying to do now is to do opt-in programs instead of opt-out programs. And what that means is they were doing a program where everybody in the school would automatically get screened, and, oh, by the way, if your parents write a letter in, then you can get pulled out of the program. Now they are encouraging everybody who's about to get screened to take a sheet home and get a signature from your parent first. So already our campaigns are having an effect. You know, I mean, opt-in is better than opt-out.
Yeah. Mm.
But that's still only a little improvement. It's like the Pledge of Allegiance. You know, if you're forced to have the Pledge of Allegiance, yeah, one or two kids can opt out, but there's still a lot of pressure, you know. So that's a concern. And what they do is they give you a list of questions, and your listeners can easily find these by just Googling things like mental health screening, and you can actually find online versions of this, of these questions that they ask you. And then they're looking for that percentage of kids that stand out. In fact, in some screening programs in Australia and Canada, they've even been looking for kids who are having signs of schizophrenia before they become schizophrenic.
God.
And they ended up with a screening question: do you believe in magical? Do you have magical thinking? And it turns out that a huge percentage of children still have magical, believe in magic and think, you know, in their thinking. So they had, the screening was too high. They ended up with way too many, and so they've ratcheted that one down, you know. It's a real frightening program because they put the kids on psychiatric drugs before they have a problem to try to prevent it. So that one, with these real powerful neuroleptic drugs. The neuroleptic drugs, people might recognize Largactyl or Thorazine, Haldol, Prolixin. Now there's Clozapine, Risperdal, Zyprexa. And these are the super powerful drugs that can cause actual brain damage, actual frontal lobe shrinkage. And they're putting a lot of people on these, like candy. They're even young children.
How young are we talking?
Worry. Pardon me?
How young?
We're finding infants under the age of five. California had to actually ban the practice of using state money to put children under the age of five on neuroleptics because so many were getting on neuroleptics.
Oh my God.
So it's even infants. And again, it's partly this chemical imbalance myth. In the United States on TV, every night they tell people, you know, it's a chemical, there's a chemical imbalance.
See these commercials all the time for,
that many
for antidepressants.
Pardon me?
We see these commercials all the time up here, I'm sure. Well, they're probably on American stations, actually, as well.
Yeah,
we're
so
seeing them on,
well,
commercials for antidepressants, you know,
yeah.
Saying, like, if you feel like this, if you feel like this, if you feel sort of like, you know, all these natural emotions, then you should take this drug.
Right.
And then sometimes at the end, there is a list of warnings and possible side effects that are longer than the commercial itself,
right.
You know? And I just think to myself,
right.
why would anybody opt for that?
And the key line that's in all these ads and on their web, you can Google Zoloft and you can read this line. They'll say that while scientists don't know exactly what causes depression, it may be a chemical imbalance. Okay, well, so far, you know, I guess we could give them that. They use the word may.
Mm.
The next sentence is Zoloft corrects this chemical imbalance. And when you think about it, that's quite a leap between
those two
sentences. So we've debated the manufacturers of Zoloft, Pfizer. It's on our website, mindfreedom.org, where we had a back and forth series of letters with them about, you know, well, where's your evidence that Zoloft corrects any chemical imbalance? Because you know what? They've never found a chemical imbalance. There's no lab test. If anyone ever tells you, if any doctor ever tells you or a loved one, well, you have a chemical imbalance, they went, well, may I see the lab test results, please? Because there is none. I mean, the fact is the mind and thinking and emotions is an emergent property, as current science is finding in complexity theory. It's an emergent phenomenon. You're not going to find a chemical level of the brain that's
normal.
Going to be off.
Can you explain what do you mean by emergent?
Right.
Property?
The current best science, and this is Nobel Prize winners, neuroscientists, biologists. It's going on in physics. They're finding that the old style machine view of the mind and body is helpful now and again. The Newtonian kind of mechanistic way of looking at things, like as if it were kind of like billiard balls. You know, our molecules. One billiard ball hits another and goes off in a certain direction.
Mm.
And that's how science has been for hundreds of years. You break the whole down to its parts and study it. And so it must have to do with the chemicals, right, the chemical levels. The newer science, which is resonance with ancient beliefs, is that the mind is an emergent property, similar that if you take hydrogen and oxygen separately, they're chemicals. You put them together, you have water. It's bigger than the parts. The whole is bigger than the sum of the parts. If you take the part sugar, you have chemicals. You put it together, it's sweet. Where did the sweetness come from?
Mm.
And so current science is saying that we're not like a machine at all. That there are people with low serotonin levels that are very happy, and there are people with high serotonin levels that are sad. The mind does not work like the oil level in your car.
Yeah, and I think that what all this is assuming is that the mind is controlled by some kind of an outside force, like a machine, in that it's all made up, and if these parts are there, then it's going to be functioning all right. But I think they're also discounting that. I think the mind can be self-programming through consciousness, in that perhaps you're in an environment that's making you feel sad, and then that's producing chemicals that maybe perhaps could be seen as a chemical imbalance, but it's something that's happening because of what your consciousness is feeling or what things you're thinking. You know what I mean? It's kind of like the chicken and the egg thing. What came first, the chemical imbalance or the result from it, like the resultant thinking? Or did the thinking come first and then that created those chemicals? Because I think the mind can kind of self-create chemicals and hormones in the body, no?
Yeah, people can read a debate we had with the American Psychiatric Association when we did a hunger strike on our website, mindfreedom.org, under campaigns, under past campaigns. We have our hunger strike, and we actually did a lengthy debate with the American Psychiatric Association on this topic, and our scientific panel definitely won. I mean, there's no study showing any chemical imbalance. We have to go back to our core values, which are about, you know, freedom, choice, empowerment, self-determination, recovery, having a voice for people in the mental health system. That's why we call for a nonviolent revolution in the mental health system, because those core values are really important to recovery. You know, your level of freedom in the long run affects if you will fully recover. By the way, the World Health Organization did a number of studies and found that your best chance of recovery from a serious mental problem is to be in the countries with the least psychiatrists or psychiatric drugs. Developing countries
Wow.
have a double chance of full recovery than in the richer countries. And we think that's because there you have more community, tolerance, acceptance, while in the richer countries you've got the labeling and the segregation and making people into clients for life.
Yeah, they want to keep people continually having this problem because then they're continually having to take the drugs. There's no motivation to get people off the drugs.
Right. That's why people talking about this with each other, these issues, and speaking out. Our movement has been doing protests. We did a protest of the pharmaceutical industry last month in D.C. Next month, we're doing Mad Pride events, including there's one in British Columbia and in Vancouver. If people email me, I'll tell them about this art showing that's part of our Mad Pride going on in about six different areas in U.S., Canada, and England, and France to celebrate being different. You know, that we all have a little bit of madness. To be human is to have a little bit of madness, eccentricity, and to celebrate that. That's something we all have in common, is our uniqueness.
Mm.
And what we're speaking about is, for people just tuning in, is the Bush administration plan to screen all United States citizens for mental illness. And I imagine for people just tuning in and people that have been listening, they might be thinking, well, why haven't we heard about this in the media yet? And a part of this article that was on dominionpaper.ca, it says that the American Psychiatric Association have made their allegiances clear on this issue, boasting of their role in suppressing attention to TMAP, which was the precursor to this new screening, and Bush's screening of America. An article that appeared in the American Psychiatric Association's membership newsletter stated that the, quote, mainstream media have not touched the story, in part thanks to the APA's work, for which the Bush administration is appreciative. I don't know how exactly they're appreciative, maybe financially. but yeah, I mean, this, I find that very scary, that the American Psychiatric Association is basically trying to suppress the information. And what I kind of question is, if they're trying to suppress this information, does that not mean that they know it's wrong?
Well, that APA, the American Psychiatric Association, did brag in their newsletter that they were able to keep this story basically on the web. And so there are a lot of websites covering it now, right wing, left wing. And in fact, yesterday there was a bill that a congressperson had in Washington, D.C., in the U.S. Congress, and unfortunately lost, but it got a bunch of votes. Parental notification law about screening. So this is on the floor of Congress yesterday. So it's getting there. It's reaching out. In fact, it's just right now there's a stir because Tom Cruise, the actor, condemned psychiatry as a pseudoscience during an interview, and we're not connected with his group. He's in the Church of Scientology and Citizens Commission on Human Rights. They do some really good work. I want to say I'm not knocking them, but a lot of people think that they're the only group working on this topic, and we are too. We have gotten some media, like when we did our hunger strike, we did get national media, but generally the corporate media has a problem, which is they're kind of the soft mind control compared to psychiatry being the hard mind control, and they tend to parrot corporate media public relations news releases. So for modern public media, you know, the mental health is a wonder drug, a latest miracle cure, and so we're really kind of off the radar with the corporate media. They're part of the problem. They're often co-owned by some of the same same big corporations, banking corporations, often own both media and insurance and pharmaceutical industries. So they have an interest in keeping the status quo. We're really part of a whole the general movement that's challenging corporate media, that's challenging unfair globalization. We're part of that the environmental movement. You know, we're part of the whole nonviolent global revolution that a lot of us hope will occur.
Yeah, I really like the connecting between different different thoughts and different sort of what would maybe be before called special interest groups, because I think most special interest groups have the same interest at heart, and so that's really neat. But you were saying to me earlier that you were at the World Health Organization meeting just recently in Italy.
Right, I just got back 8 days ago from Italy, where the World Health Organization co-sponsored a 400-person global conference on helping the voice of people who've been through the mental health system get out. And the head of the mental health section, Dr. Saraceno, actually made quite a number of public statements and put it out in writing, directly responding to our concerns and naming Mind Freedom, naming me, naming our concerns, and itemizing them and responding to a number of them. So we were really gratified by that. Of course, the proof's in the pudding, you know, and the results. But we've had a campaign for the last few years to speak out, to declare a global emergency of human rights violations in the mental health system, and that's for both poor and rich countries. And he emphasized that again, that he's using the term global emergency because the human rights violations are so extreme and severe, and not just from lack of care, but he said by the current care system is an emergency. Also, they agreed with us and have put out in writing in a document they just released this week on legislation, they have agreed with us to call for a ban, a global ban on forced electroshock. Now, we're against all electroshock, but to have a major governmental body agree with us and call publicly in writing for a ban on forced electroshock, I'm trying to tell our people, this is a big deal.
Oh, yeah.
You know? I mean, I know a lot of our folks are pretty skeptical and cynical, and I don't blame them about government agencies, but here's somebody who's going out on a limb, and I think we need to jump on this and get that out, because this is the first time I've seen that. The big news is that they've also called for building toward a global congress sponsored by the World Health Organization of people who've been through the mental health system in 2009. So over the next 4 years, the WHO will be developing groups in poorer countries of people who've been through the mental health system, and then bringing these delegates from all over the world to a world congress, which is history-making. I mean, I've never heard of anything like that in my three decades. So, you know, we'll still be speaking out, you know, protesting and everything with the WHO, but we want to really also, you know, take advantage of this diplomatic opening here with this important body.
Now, you say you've been involved with this kind of work for three decades or 30 years, so How did you get your start in all of this, and what kind of drew you to this type of work that you're doing?
Right, yeah, I like to say my recruiting room was in the 1970s a solitary confinement cell inside of a psychiatric facility, because that's where I, you know, made my decision to work on human rights in this field. What was happening is I was a working class kid from Chicago who got a scholarship to go to Harvard. I was very into social change and rebellion, and I went into these emotional and spiritual altered states, very vulnerable and overwhelmed states of mind where I thought the TV or radio was personally speaking to me. So if any of your listeners think I am personally speaking just to them, they will, you know, experience a little bit of what I was going through for periods of time, so-called classic schizophrenic experiences.
Right.
And so they Harvard locked me up in what's considered one of the best institutions in the world, and I was put in solitary confinement and held down and forcibly drugged. And I felt very demeaned by this. The drugs, the neuroleptics that I was on, like Haldol, Haloperidol, were just so overwhelming. They felt like wrecking balls to my mind, and I just felt like, you know, something must be done, and there must be some better way to help people that's less degrading and humiliating. And so in my senior year, Harvard Social Service Agency referred me to volunteer with one of these early movement groups. It's been about 1970 a lot of groups have started. This one was called Mental Patients Liberation Front in Massachusetts, and I wrote my senior paper on it, and I graduated anyway, despite being locked up five times. I graduated with honors in 1977 from Harvard, and I've been doing community organizing work in this field ever since. So that's how I got my start, and what I found, you know, after getting into this field, is that a lot of people have just horrible experiences. I mean, some people have positive experiences with the mental health system, but we're all united that just like abuse, say, in the Catholic Church, you know, a lot of church members in the Catholic Church have good experiences, but they're all united in wanting to stop the abuse by priests. And it's the same thing with psychiatry. It's time to imprison some of these abusive psychiatrists. And the ones who are silent and complicit, they need to be challenged too.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's a pretty radical view. I mean, I agree. It's great to hear it, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, things like forced psychiatric drugging, forced electroshock, restraints, the defamation of labeling, denying people liberty, these are criminal acts. These are human rights violations that violate the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. We're the only group of our kind with UN status, consultative roster status. So for the last 3 years, we've had a team in the UN in meetings about disability rights. So the disability movement really gets us. They understand this. We're part of the cross-disability movement. And they really support us and see that this is about human rights and our violations of our fundamental human rights.
So once again, just tell us about the things that are going on in the future in terms of protests and things that are planned and events and stuff like that.
Well, like I said, for the last 5 years we've been doing Mad Pride events, and we picked July 14th, Bastille Day, because for 25 years, this July 14th, a group in New York has been using Bastille Day to speak out about human rights violations in the mental health system. It turns out at the very bottom of the Bastille, there were two people with psychiatric labels that were also liberated during the storming of the Bastille. So our movement has used mid-July as a time to speak out, and there'll be a wonderful march in England between two cities pushing a hospital bed with a mannequin tied down in four-point restraints to illustrate just how brutal a mental health system is. That's their Mad Pride one. And Toronto is having theater. And also, by the way, in May in Toronto, the American Psychiatric Association meets there. So people are already talking about like an anti-globalization protest of the American Psychiatric Association in May in Toronto. Mad Pride event, like I said, in next month in Vancouver. A little art show. We'll be at the Oregon Country Fair in Vineta, Oregon, where we always are. It's a huge fair that we reach people. And the main event in New York, there'll be a week-long fast and camp out on the state capitol in Albany. And our group in France always lays a wreath on the actual Bastille. So those are some of the Mad Pride events. Another thing people in British Columbia might want to get interested in, Francesca Allen, who was on your show recently, she is pioneering a Mind Freedom British Columbia to get one going there and to start an affiliate there. So I'd encourage everybody to consider that. You don't have to be a psychiatric survivor to be active in this field. This is something that affects everybody.
Yeah.
Well, according to this screening, we might all be a bit insane.
Well, the U.S. government just released a major study that they claim that 1/4 of the U.S. currently has a psychiatric disability disorder, and that during your lifetime, half of people experience it. Of course, with the standing of the U.S. now, a lot of the world would say 100% of the United States has a mental disorder. Or certainly starting at the White House, we know somebody there who has a severe mental disorder.
That's
you. He hears voices. You know, President Bush claims he hears voices told him to invade Iraq. He claims they're God. I claim they're the rich. You know, he just kind of mixed it up. This is something that affects everybody. And if it doesn't affect you directly, it'll affect a loved one and may currently affect a loved one. Because, everybody goes through a crisis. Everybody has an eccentricity or difference.
Everybody.
You know, everybody. This is something, the way I say it is, if normality is doing so great, why is the environment in an eco-crisis? Why are we having an environmental crisis?
And the world itself, in general, is in a bit of a critical state right now.
Exactly. Yeah, war, poverty, environmental catastrophe. So this kind of control over how people think and be is a real threat. Martin Luther King actually said a lot of this in his speeches. He had a theme in some of his speeches and some of his essays where he'd say that that psychologists have a favorite word, and that's maladjusted. Back then, and he said the salvation of the world lies in the hands of the maladjusted, because there are many things we ought to be maladjusted to.
Good point.
So real, real deep change will kind of look crazy. That first person has to say or think something very different. So this enforcement of normality is a core issue. I was in the environmental movement. I was in the peace movement. For years as a paid activist, and this issue is one of the cornerstone issues that holds a lot of other movements back.
And if this is what's normal, then change must seem crazy.
Well, if you look at a really good nonviolent civil disobedience protest with the singing and the signs and the colorful signs and everything, there is a kind of a craziness to it that is different than normality, but it's an organized craziness.
Wonderful.
And that's what we need. We need to get on that edge and have massive nonviolent protests in many different forms. Also promote alternatives. A lot of our members are engaged in really creative alternatives. Peer support programs, drop-in centers, counseling programs, housing, employment programs. So there's a wonderful drop-in center, the Vancouver-Richmond Mental Health Network in Vancouver. That's one of our 100 sponsor groups in our coalition. So there's a lot of alternatives. And I think people can just talk about these things. There's a real mute button on this issue. Don't talk about it. You might be considered crazy. Your listeners can do a lot just by talking about it, asking questions. What do you think about all the drugging of the kids going on?
How do you even tell a 5-year-old has?
Pardon me?
How can you even decide that a 5-year-old is mentally ill? I don't know, you know. Yeah. I mean, and kids are all, they all act wild and wacky and,
We're asking people not to use the term mentally ill even at all, because, you know, if you want to talk about emotional and mental upset, distress, overwhelm, then use those words.
Mm-hmm.
If you use terms like mentally ill, really, that just there's just a percentage of people believe in that, and you know, we should be inclusive of all kinds of beliefs. There are people who believe their problems are from spiritual or problems, economic, political. We ought to welcome everybody in.
Mm-hmm.
So language is one way to fight back on this.
Yeah, I agree. I guess we should we want to wrap up here. I just want to ask you one of the thing that first came to my mind when I read the story where I first read it, dominionpaper.ca, was, you know, this is Nazi Germany putting people into groups, lunatics, gypsies, whatever. That's what was done in Nazi Germany, was sort of categorizing people, and then it makes it a lot easier to intern people. And that's really scary. So I'm glad that we're able to sort of get this out, because I think you're right. If we talk about these things, then it really takes the power out of it.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because directly after our protest of pharma in D.C. last month, we visited an ongoing special exhibit at the U.S. Memorial Holocaust Museum. They have a special, wonderful, big exhibit called Deadly Medicine, and it's about the role that medicine played in the Holocaust. Medicine, especially psychiatry, helped develop the theories, the paperwork, even the methods of killing that were used in the early days of the Holocaust. Because, you know, people, kids especially with mental disabilities, labeled retarded and so forth, they were one of the most vulnerable groups. And that's the canary in the coal mine, that, you know,
right.
If that canary gets sick, you can know that there's some gas in that coal mine. And the same thing with targeting the least powerful group, which is folks defined as mentally disabled. So that exhibit showed the roots of the Holocaust, the medical cloak that was put over the unimaginable violence of the Holocaust. It was done with a medical cloak, paperwork, labels, scientific white coat.
Nice term.
The whole thing. And I'm seeing that now. Right now, people. What breaks my heart, I was forcibly drugged in an institution. I'm getting calls and email almost, you know, every week or so of people who are being court-ordered to be on psychiatric drugs while at home, living out in the community. And this is going on in Canada, like in Ontario and other provinces, where people are court-ordered to be on these powerful drugs while
Jeez.
Living at home peacefully out in the community. And they even visit them in their homes and inject them. And for me, that is just like Nazi Germany.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
These drugs can cause brain damage, lobotomy, and can kill and addict. Horrible torture. And this is how we're treating the folks who are just labeled different.
And yet we're not even allowed...
Pardon me?
We're not even allowed to self-medicate with drugs that are... relatively harmless and beneficial.
It's about empowerment, you know.
Yeah.
Are people given full information, a range of alternatives? That's the question, and right now, no. If you're in trouble, you're pushed in one direction, and that's a human rights violation, and the general public should speak out about it. Like I say, in the U.S., I'm seeing signs both right-wing and left-wing speaking out. Can you imagine an issue that unites the right and left-wing? I mean, we may be able to unite these two wings, you know?
Yeah. One last thing is, a friend of mine was just, a good friend of mine was recently in the hospital getting a transplant. Two transplants, actually, and one of the things, this is about 6 weeks ago when it happened, 2 months ago, one of the things he said when he came out, when I just saw him, was that the whole time he was in hospital, nobody touched him.
Uh-huh.
You know, there was no sort of like hands-on, like he said, I'm just dying for a massage, he said.
Right.
I can't believe But a Vancouver General Hospital, they don't have somebody that'll come in there and offer, you know, like for $20 or whatever, I'll give you a massage while you're in your bed. Like, and he said it would have made all the difference in the world. I mean,
that's
they have no
revealed.
Problem cutting him open and reaching their hands in and ripping stuff out and squashing it back in there, but to actually like put their hands on his muscles. And,
right.
and you said the same thing. And I just wonder if there is hope for the psychiatric and the medical establishment to sort of finally relinquish some control and say, hey, let's let non-Western medicine in here and maybe we can all sort of work together.
I have a lot of hope. We actually work with a lot of dissident mental health professionals that are in an organization called International Center for Study of Psychiatry and Psychology, and I go to their conferences, and there's a lot of dissident mental health professionals that are on our side. We have a number of their books on our, I'll give a plug, our Mad Market, madmarket.org is our bookstore and our products, and a lot of authors are on our side. The thing we've got on our side is things like mutual support. I mean, the corporate medicine is based on distancing, control.
Yeah. Divide and conquer.
So that's why they can't give, you know, a massage. It's, though some hospitals, by the way, are. There's a few that are doing that. But you know, we need to use that mutual support. And what we do is real simple. One thing, you know, if I say is to your listeners to take away, is that we unite the power of mutual support with the power of activism. And I think that's something that we can help offer other movements, because there's so much division and infighting and burnout and everything. And our people have been through hell. I mean, one of our board members had forced electroshock at the age of 6.
Wow.
So, you know, we have something to offer, which is the human spirit, you know, can keep coming back and is resilient, but combine that power of mutual support with activism. I'd love to hear from any of your listeners. They can email me personally if they want to. It's an easy email address. It's Oaks, O-A-K-S, like the tree, no E, just O-A-K-S, four letters, oaks@mindfreedom.org, oaks@mindfreedom.org, and I'll link you in with, you know, what's going on in B.C., the Mad Pride event, Francesca,
great,
wanting to organize in B.C., if you want a free issue of our journal, just email me, oaks@mindfreedom.org, tell me you heard the show, and love to hear from you.
Perfect.
Well, thank you very much, David.
Wonderful.
So
thank
you
so
very
much for your work.
You bet. And
very
thank you for yours.
What you're doing. Thank you.
And have a good day and a rest of the year in life.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.